There is so much that goes into one bottle of wine. So much time, so many resources, so much careful thought.
This big body of water, Lake Michigan, it has so much love to give us.
I was the young generation, now I'm the old one. It's funny how that happens, you know?
I'm adverse to publications of wine to some degree because the people that are writing these articles are living in a vacuum.
Americans have embraced wine more. We've become more of a wine culture.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 318. This week, we feature Mike and Nicole Duffy of Optima Winery in Sonoma. Nicole Duffy of Optima Winery in Sonoma calls Milwaukee a huge wine community. Of course, Milwaukee is the home to this podcast, but more importantly, to Nicole's point, wine has grown in popularity all over the country. Open a bottle, and the conversation begins. The best part is when winemakers come to visit various markets to talk about their wines. In this case, Mike and Nicole Duffy, co-owners of Optima Winery in Sonoma, paid a visit to the LBTV studios, cracked a bottle, and continued that wine conversation. Listen to Mike Duffy in our Vino Lingo segment giving us his definition of the term flabby. Welcome to Milwaukee, and I'm here with Mike and Nicole Duffy. How are you both doing?
Great.
Doing great.
Great. And you're from Healdsburg Optima Winery. And Nicole, you said you've been here before. Mike, you as well, or no?
My first visit.
Really?
Yeah.
So what do you think of Milwaukee?
So far, so good. We got in late last night and peeked out this morning, and I wondered where all the traffic was, the rush hour. So.
Yeah, our rush hours are a little different than where you were just in Boston, you said, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Milwaukee is slowly but surely discovering wine, and I'm sure you've already discovered that because you've been here before, Nicole,
yes.
Correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Huge wine community.
Right, right. People are learning. Beer
yes.
is not dominating anymore.
Absolutely.
Which is great. So you're in Sonoma, and is your tasting room in Healdsburg?
Correct.
Okay. Is it on the square or a particular part of the city?
It's actually out in Dry Creek area.
Oh, okay. Good. Well, we'll come to that in a few minutes. So the first question, logically, is how long have you been? I know, Mike, you've been in the wine business for quite some time. And I guess I'm going to start with you. Tell me a little bit about your beginnings.
I graduated Davis in, 1981. I'd grown up about 3 hours north of where we live now in wine country, a town called Redding. And high school, made homemade beer and homemade wine with my dad. That seemed very cool. And somebody told me that there was actually a profession. There was actually a degree in nearby UC Davis. And so I was a declared enology student as a sophomore in high school.
Nice. So you really dove right in.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, I liked the idea. I really, really was looking forward to working with agriculture. The seasonality appealed to me, but making a product that was somewhat more elevated than ketchup and
Were you making ketchup too?
No, I wasn't making ketchup.
You never know. There's probably a pretty good market for ketchup. But Redding's not really any kind of a well-known wine area. Were you influenced by going south to some of the better-known wine country, or...?
As far as production, yeah. Back when I graduated, there was still immediate opportunity to be into, you know, production as a winemaker, an assistant winemaker over in both Napa, Sonoma. You know, that was quite a while ago. So yeah.
Yeah, I don't suppose much was going on in Mendocino, that area, quite yet, or in Anderson Valley. Although there was some, but
there was some. One of my classmates had a family winery up in Anderson Valley called Hush.
Oh, yeah, sure. So, I've tried their wine. In fact, I've been there.
Yeah.
And Nicole, your experience in wine?
My experience in wine. Well, I had an accounting degree.
Well, of course.
And yes, and I actually went to Gary Heck at Korbel and asked him how I could break into the wine business on the accounting side of it. And he said that it was mostly family-run wineries. And so, lo and behold, I moved up to Healdsburg from Santa Rosa, which is a whopping 18 miles north. And I had an 11-year-old son, and he played on a traveling soccer team. And so we tried out for a team, and the coach was Mike Duffy. Didn't know who Mike was or what Mike had done, but long story short, I invited him over for a glass of wine, and I pulled out a bottle of Optima Chardonnay. And he said, oh, come on, that is my wine. I make that wine. And
what are the odds?
Yeah, and I said, no way. There's no way. Tell me you own, like, Jordan or Ferrari Carano so you could fly me all over the world. Yeah. He goes, well, no, but I own this, and you drink it.
Wow.
So I said, well, I'm a single mom who can't afford your wine, so I have to marry you. And he said, well, one question, do you drink red wine? And I said, no, I drink Chardonnay. And he said, well, when you grow up and drink red wine, I'll marry you. Wow. So that was 2 years later, and we were married, and then I joined the business, and have been happy ever since.
That's good. How long have you been married?
18 years.
Mm-hmm.
Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
Good
Thank
for you.
You.
That's a nice length of time.
Yeah.
Well, I wish you many more.
Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to go back to you, Mike. You obviously, you didn't go right to your own winery. Did you work for other wineries? Did you travel? What was your start after you had the education?
I actually started before I had the education, or just slightly before. I started Davis in 77. And my junior year, the end of my junior year, the first quarter of my senior year, I decided to take an internship over at Napa. And I worked, so I took fall off, I worked crush, and I worked over at Trefethen, which is just north of the city of Napa. And wow, it was phenomenal. It was fantastic. They were... they had all their own vineyards, so I began in the summer, and I was, field sampling, and then we transitioned into harvest, and they did, back in the day, we did probably 900 tons-ish. They were 100% machine harvested, so that was new.
And what year was that?
This is in 1980.
Wow, machine harvesting in 80.
Yeah, they actually developed the entire vineyard to be machine harvested, planted from the very, very beginning. Anyway, I had a great, great harvest. The family, the winemaker there, the staff was just wonderful, very supportive. And so my internship ended in December. And during harvest, the assistant winemaker that was there got an offer from another Napa winery to become winemaker. And so they had an opening at assistant winemaker, which is what I would have been applying for, once I graduated. And so they asked me if I'd like the job. I said, yes, I would, but I've just got one more year to get a degree. Seems a shame to... forfeit that. Mm. So we made an arrangement. I worked 3 days a week, went to school 3 days a week, and busted out senior year in 2 quarters.
Man, you must have been going crazy. That's a lot of work.
But I was highly motivated.
Yeah, right.
I was sick of being a broke college kid. Seriously sick of it.
As many people are at that point in life. But to be able to go into wine, I mean, that's such a completely different business. And I mean, you had to have been pretty freaked out being able to get that opportunity.
It was wonderful. It was wonderful. We hired, that is Trefethen, hired a crush intern every year. And so upon graduation, I got to interview fellow classmates for the...
Oh, nice. I hope your classmates were nice to you.
Some were. Some hit the round file sooner than later.
Well, that's just it. I mean, you get to see who's got the hunger, who's... got to have it, got to want it. So, Nicole, are you from California originally?
I am, born and raised.
Nice. Santa Rosa?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Just wanted to get that while the door slammed. So. What was the road to Optima? I guess I should actually, how long has Optima been around?
1984.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent. So is that your next step, or did you go through a couple other wineries? Or?
I left Trefethen in 82. I did the crush in 82 and then took a job over in near Healdsburg in the, what would become the Chalk Hill Appellation. Sure. And about a year after taking that jump, did my first harvest in 84.
You just hopped in? I mean, that's not even back then, it was not an easy thing to jump into in a very complicated business plan for opening a winery.
My plan was not complicated.
Nope.
In 83, I married my first wife, Tina. She passed away in 2001. And we had gotten married and we had been filing as individuals, so we got a $6,000 tax return. And that was the impetus for my, the payment rather, for my first harvest. So, and the plan was just make some wine and do it yourself. I was kind of on the, you know, entering the age of exploration still. And one of the reasons I chose, you know, to move from Napa Valley was Trefethen had a very successful, very clear-cut winemaking protocol. They knew what worked. They knew what didn't. They were super successful at it. And I just wanted to try stuff. And not necessarily oddball varieties, but barrel ferment Chardonnay. Go make Cabernet from Alexander Valley. You know, how's that different than Napa?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and a big difference too.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Nicole, for you entering into the business, once you find out this guy makes this wine and you get married, I mean, you're part in the business. Are you in accounting or are you actually involved beyond that?
So we're a very small winery, so I have to wear all hats. The only thing I really don't do is chemistry, but I drive the forklift and I shovel tanks and then I go out and sell the wine and I do the accounting of the winery. I do it all, and which is really good because I learned Mike. Always used to make fun of me because I would ask questions and he'd say, well, go to Davis, they'll teach you.
And did you?
No, I did not. So I had to learn the hard way just by watching and listening and learning that way. And I'm so thankful that I did because I have a true passion for wine now. And I understand the whole evolution of it and how it all works.
How many cases are you guys making?
We do, of the Optima brand, we probably do 1,500.
And your other brand is?
The other brand is Fitch Mountain Cellars. And we've had that since we started, also in 1984, started the Optima brand. They were kind of born together. The Optima brand, I began the brand making Cabernet Sauvignon. And, of course, Cabernet takes a little while to sit in barrels and do its thing, and so there's an investment, both in time and money, in terms of starting with Cabernet. So we needed to fund, you know, the project, and so we created a second label that was kind of featured wines that were a little earlier to market, and also wines that were a little more didn't necessarily need that long an oak, and that were a little more fruit forward, user friendly, kind of restaurant driven.
And about how many of those are you doing?
Probably 2,000.
Mm-hmm. And I guess let's go back to, obviously we talked about Cabernet here, and what else are you making?
Since we moved over to Healdsburg, we started with Cabernet, and so I've made that since 1984. We made a little bit of Pinot for a while in the 90s, and then in 2000, we had a wonderful little vineyard in right near Windsor, south of the town of Windsor. And as Windsor expanded, that vineyard became three bedroom houses and a soccer field.
Oh, that's sad.
It was wonderful. It was a a vineyard that belonged to Martinelli. Ted Segasio at Segasio Vineyards and I split the vineyard, and both of us just loved it. But it disappeared right around 2000. And we had the opportunity to look around for more Pinot, or we chose to kind of explore some varieties out in Dry Creek. So we also make a Petit Syrah and a Zinfandel from Dry Creek.
Nice. So you're not making any Pinot at all these days?
No.
Interesting. Whites?
Gewürztraminer. Nicole and I, one of our favorite wine when we go out is had been. Prior to making our own, we used to order Alsatian Gewürztraminers. Okay. Yeah.
So and a very underrated wine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very elegant, very complex. I had to talk my grower out in Dry Creek into literally budding over an acre of Merlot to Gewürztraminer for me, and that took about 4 years. And so we began producing it probably around, 2012?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that must have been a heck of a conversation.
Yes, yeah.
When it comes in, for our listeners, for dollars and cents. And
that's exactly
and,
right.
And he has lost quite a bit of money on that vineyard because it does not produce a lot.
Mm.
So he must really love us.
He does.
Well, I've always made the joke, God knows how many times, that making wine is a lousy business plan. I mean, when you look at the idea of how you start and how you finish. I mean, kind of going back to when you began, you plant, you wait, and you have no income, in essence.
Right.
I mean, was there something, were you making wine for anybody else at the time just to kind of survive?
Yes, had a day job.
A day job.
Yeah.
Yeah. A winemaker with a day job.
Right.
I'm going to come back to you, Nicole, and, you know, this idea of Gewürztraminer, how would you explain that to someone? Because so many people are afraid of it.
Of Gewürztraminer?
Yeah, they just don't, you know, it's kind of a funny name, and it's a little scary. And it's a great example. What we do is demystifying that wine. How would you do that?
Well, oftentimes they do have a hard time pronouncing it. So I tell them to call it Gewürz, just cut it off, or GW, just to simplify it.
That's how we abbreviate it to the winery in all of our tanks.
And then the way I explain it is, you know, it's just a nice, spicy, floral wine. Oftentimes it can be sweet. Ours is dry, which is what we prefer. But I am always telling people, even if you're not interested, try it, right? I didn't like sushi when I first met Mike, but that's his favorite food. So I would have to go to restaurants and try it. And each time as I tried stuff, I started to learn an appreciation for it. And now I love sushi. So same with wine. You know, just have a sip and you might find something that you really enjoy.
Well, to your example of Chardonnay before, that's one of those where people say, well, I don't drink Chardonnay.
Yeah.
It's like, well, have you tried this?
Yeah.
You know, really, one thing about being a winemaker, you wear more hats than I can begin to count. I mean, you have retail, you have wholesale, you're a manufacturer, you're creative, you're all this stuff. But you're also a wine educator, because everybody you talk to, you're trying to explain to them why they shouldn't be afraid of it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bit of a challenge, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I had a young man in the tasting room, and they were all, it was a group of maybe 10, and I have to give this guy props. He said, so how do you know how many strawberries to dump in your rosé, or how much coffee to add to your, you know, Cabernet? And it just made me realize, like, there's a lot of education that needs to be happening here. And I had to explain to him that, you know, no, we don't weigh out the pounds of coffee and throw it in the wine, that it all comes from the earth, or, you know, whatnot. And so he was so thankful, you know, and a lot of people, we don't judge, we want to educate. That's very important to us.
Well, sure, isn't it the age-old, the dumb question, or the question you don't ask?
Yeah.
There are no dumb questions.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although that's one I've never heard before.
Yeah, it was cute.
Yeah.
It was cute.
I'll bet.
He was so embarrassed.
I would have been.
There's this idea of, trying wine from everywhere, because 50 states are now making wine.
Yeah.
And some of these states make some extraordinary wine. It's not just Sonoma and Napa. And
yeah.
That's good for everybody, isn't it?
Absolutely. I was at a tasting in Omaha, Nebraska, and a gentleman walked up to me and said, can you direct me to the Omaha winery? And I thought he was joking. And I said, oh, yeah, sure, you know. And he goes, no, seriously, is there a table for the Omaha wines? And it just dawned on me, like, okay, wow, that's, you know, that's cool. Everybody has it. Wine is art. And so it doesn't matter where you make it from. It's their art, you know, whether we like it or not.
That's a good answer. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to direct this specifically to you, Mike, for your length of time you've been in the business, and I'm sure you've done plenty of interviews like this. Hopefully better ones so far. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. You know, when we do something we love, we like to talk about it. What's the question you've never been asked that you'd like to be asked as a winemaker?
Wow. I think I've been asked them all.
Really?
Oh, seriously. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question, but I don't have an answer for you.
Yeah, sometimes you get interesting answers, and this has been kind of my favorite go-to these days.
Yeah, uh-huh. I like that question.
Yeah. Can you think of anything for you, Nicole, because you're obviously in a different position?
How about why are you still doing this?
Yeah, right?
I usually ask that question. What are you, nuts? Well, and to take that away for just a second, I mean, being in California is not the easiest thing in the world. You've had earthquakes, you've had fires, you've had floods. It is a challenging business, and it's certainly not for the faint at heart.
It's become challenging. It's gradually become more and more challenging, not just from the, you know, that perspective, but the proliferation of brands means that your presence gets diluted over the years, and over the years there's new customers that are continually, it's kind of that natural progress where there's new customers that are rediscovering you, and at the same time, you know, there's plenty of brands for them to discover. So,
and I guess you should always remember, don't believe everything that's in the news.
True.
Fake news. You know, we did experience a lot of fires, and we have experienced some flooding, but Wine Country is not burned down.
Yeah.
We are all good there. We lost two wineries out of both Napa and Sonoma. Most people that do now venture out, because they are a little bit timid, say we don't even see any damage, and you really don't. The vineyards actually helped break the fires.
Yeah.
So the news basically made it seem like, you know, Wine Country is no longer. And that's frustrating and hard for an industry that's so dependent on tourism and you know, people coming out. So. Fake news.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that was right. You know, one of the things we're trying to do is spread that word to people. You will not see what has happened unless you really search for it. It's a big deal. Well, and so many wineries are family, just like you guys, family owned.
Mm-hmm.
More than people realize, it's not a huge corporate. There are certainly plenty of corporations, but at last count, I can only speak for Napa, the association, the Vintners Association, is dominated by family still.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, our proudest moment as a family winery was we had driven up to the winery and we were expecting grapes in about 2 hours. And it was, what, 6, 7 in the morning? We were expecting grapes. And we had left our crusher outside, and somebody had come and tried to tear it apart for the value of the metal.
Stainless steel.
Yeah.
Stainless steel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so Mike said, oh, gosh, and I'm freaking out. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? And Mike loves to work with his hands, and he's very, very mechanical. And so he said, well, remember all those tools that you complain about? He goes, those are going to be making money today. Watch me. And so they had taken our hopper, which is where the grapes go down into the crusher, and he had built a hopper within that day. It was out of wood. It wasn't out of metal that day, or steel. And then he had to make some other plates for the crusher to work.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time that we were ready to fire up the machine, it was late in the evening.
Yeah.
And we called, we have four boys. And we called our boys. Our youngest at the time was maybe 4, and our oldest was 16. And all of them came down, and there was no fighting. There was no complaining. We all put our heads down. We had our littlest on the forklift with the flashlight. And I just stood there as in awe that our kids understand now what a family business is. And we got it done.
The grower came back that evening to pick up his bins after we were done crushing. And he saw how I'd made this repair. And all the kids were there, and they were, you know, we were hosing the floor down and cleaning stuff up. And he went over to Nicole and he says, you know, when they talk about a family winery, they ought to, this is what they ought to.
We're the poster children.
Yeah, this is the picture you ought to see.
Do you have pictures of that?
I don't think we do, because I don't think cell phones had.
It was very early
cell phone.
We didn't
have the iPhone.
Wasn't the instantaneous thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But our oldest now just graduated UC Davis in enology as well. So he is manning the winery, which is allowing Mike to
travel more. Go fishing more.
Well, I imagine that's any parent's dream in wine country, although not something you want to force your kids into.
No.
Other than maybe manual labor when they're young.
Which
he
we did.
He did his time, manual labor. And he came to me and told me, yeah, he first, he worked for me for a little bit and worked for a couple of years. And working for your dad is not, it's not good for his growth. So after that, I encouraged him to go work for somebody else, and he did. There was another winery in Healdsburg, and he worked for them for about 4 years.
Yep. Worked on the bottling line,
They had a mobile bottling line, so he worked in the winery, and then he also kind of took off on the road once in a while to do this bottling. And he finally came to me and said that he wanted to be in the business. He was sure of it. And I told him that, you know, I thought that was a great choice. He was uniquely qualified and that he had done enough, you know, investigating to know whether it was for him or not. But that I highly encouraged him to go to Davis and get a degree, because there's lots of people that, you know, I mean, there's plenty of winemakers that aren't Davis trained. Davis will give you that ability to work wherever you want. You can go to Australia, New Zealand, go to Europe, go anywhere.
Sure, it's credit.
So, and I really didn't want him to, you know, be suspect, or his winemaking be suspect, because he's the winemaker, because daddy owns the winery.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, that's a good attitude.
Yeah. So he embraced it. Of course, it was a 5-year, it was 3 years at the JC over in Santa Rosa and 2 years at Davis.
Nice. Good for him.
Yeah.
Well, good for his parents, too, to raise a kid that's going to go into wine, the business you're in.
Yep.
And who knows where it could lead.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I'm a little curious about your label, for Optima specifically. Where did that come from? Where did that idea come from?
So Mike, like Mike had mentioned, him and his late wife had designed the label, our first label, which was more of a diamond shaped. Back in the 80s, most people named their winery after their last name. And as you can see, Mike is more of a humble man. He doesn't like a lot of recognition. He found that a lot of Italians had their wineries, and it was hard to pronounce. So he wanted something simple, something that was easy to remember, and came up with Optima, which is, the meaning is, the finest outcome of many things.
Mm-hmm.
So then I came along and decided that I wanted, over a time, to change the label from a diamond to a more modern label, and with much resistance.
I got a good run out of that first label. It went from unchanged from 84 until 2011.
Yeah.
But this is a cool label. I mean, I specifically asked Joe to take a look at it, and because I've seen it before, and I was trying to call it back to mind, and I like it, and it's very attractive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So there is a little diamond on that label. That is Mike's resistance, that he still has a diamond on it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actual logo, the design, has really two meanings. We are very family-oriented. And so, like, the outward swiggles are our kids, and the inward is Mike and I. And then the other is that, you know, all the elements of wine come together into a center point where it creates Optima. So.
Well, congratulations for your history. That's impressive. And Sonoma's just a wonderful place for wine. In fact, to me, for many people, when they ask me about California wine, it's a great go-to because the prices are still reasonable there.
Yeah.
Kind of a little hidden secret that's not so hidden.
It's a great place to work. Yes, yes. There's probably more debt service over in Napa Valley than there is where we are.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we won't get into that, will we? So obviously we talked about your tasting room in the beginning, and I'm wondering, is that for our listeners, can they just stop by? Is it by appointment? What is the situation?
So here's the thing. We have our production over on Grant, and for many, many years, we had had a tasting room inside the cellar.
That was by appointment
only. That was by appointment only. Mm-hmm. And winemakers like to shove things places, and they always have their labs running all over the place, and it was quite a hassle for me to be able to walk into the winery and just have a tasting. So we, after 37 years, we're opening up a tasting room in Dry Creek. Once our permit goes through, we will be open 7 days a week. And
dedicated tasting room.
Yep, dedicated tasting room.
Yeah. Excellent. Mm-hmm. What road are you going to be on?
It's right on Dry Creek.
Right off of Dry Creek.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Just trying to visualize it myself.
Up by family winemakers.
Sure. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Up there.
If our listeners would like to learn about you online, how would they do that? What's your website?
OptimaWinery.com. And then we have Facebook and Instagram that they can learn, and that they can call us at 707-431-8222.
Great.
And you'll talk to me.
That's the best part. You can talk to the owners. Isn't that cool?
Yeah.
I hope people appreciate that.
Yeah.
Mike, Nicole, thank you very much for taking the time to stop by the studio. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Learn more by visiting OptimaWinery.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak and Catherine Shearer. Copyright 2019.